So I'd like to begin with a quote from His Holiness the Dalai Lama. He said, "Our greatest task is to become more fully human. Our greatest task is to become more fully human." And I love that quote. I love that he said that. And I love that it's true, in my opinion. And I believe that coming into contact with, being able to experience and understand the three centers will help us, will support us in becoming more fully human. And it's said some people are more, have a proclivity to one center more than another. And maybe we each do. Maybe some of us are more body people, or some of us are more heart people. Some of us are more head people, mind people. But which is fine to have that proclivity, but not to be limited to our proclivity, but to keep expanding our understanding of who and what we are and who and what is here, so that it includes body, heart, and mind quite fully. The totality of what's sitting here starts to become revealed by practice, by the Dharma, and by focusing in the way we have been in this retreat on the three centers, starting with the body of awakening and the embodiment of being, and then the heart of compassion, the heart really of love, that is about the goodness of being, and also the head center, which is traditionally called the eye of wisdom, the head center. And it's about waking up fully, body, heart, mind. And some of the characteristics of the head center, I'll talk about a few and I'll go into some detail on some. But one of the first is when the head center is open, there's openness, right? There's not a rigidity in the mind. There's a spaciousness and an openness to discovery and a sense of wonder about reality, about any moment. Because as you know, and as you see, and as the Dharma shows us, not by telling us, by practicing it, every moment is brand new. Every moment is brand new. Absolutely brand new. This moment has never happened before. And please raise your hand if I'm wrong about this, because I don't think I'm wrong. And even though we've seen each other in these little boxes before, this moment of seeing each other in these little Zoom squares has never happened before. Other moments have happened, but not this moment. And what you're thinking and feeling and what's happening for you as I'm speaking, similar things may have happened, but this moment has never, ever happened before. And as far as I can tell, so far, and I'm open to continue to learn and discover with the Dharma, that's true, that this moment has never happened and will never happen again. And it's part of the beautiful truth of impermanence, that it's just, there's just a moment of experience and then the next moment of experience and then the next moment. And each moment is brand new. And when the head center opens, really when all three centers begin to open, it opens us to the wonder of being alive, of being here, of this moment. And it doesn't mean The wonder said, the wonder doesn't say everything is just wonderful, because that wouldn't be true. But there's still a wonder in the freshness or the newness or the, I want to say vivacity, but I'm not even sure if that's a word, vivacity, the vividness of reality when we're here, when we're fully present, when the spaciousness and openness of mind and heart is here, then the moment of reality is brand new and is vivid, is both at times obvious, but still brand new. And so part of the head center is this openness and spaciousness that comes when we relax the mind, when our minds are not tight, and a sense of not knowing what's going to happen. And not knowing is one of the great spiritual teachings that's taught in many traditions, sometimes called the wisdom of not knowing or the goodness of not knowing. And if you've sat with me over the years, you've heard me talk about it, because I like not knowing, mostly because I don't know, right? It's just, it's not even a big discovery, but it's still, you know, it's always new reality in a certain way, because we don't know what's going to happen. And maybe even at some level, we don't know what reality is. We're discovering it fresh at each moment. And it's got this, again, I want to say vivacity, this vividness to it when we're here. And it can be with a breath, or with a sound, or a smell, or a taste, or a touch, or a thought, or a feeling. Even the same old thought, when there's a sense of openness and not knowing what a thought is, like that's good practice in my mind, really. Because, I mean, what is a thought? Right? It's usually, often we say it's some words, or Pam said earlier today, she said sometimes it comes as pictures. But what is that? Where is it? Can you show me one of your thoughts right now? Can somebody give me one of your thoughts so I could have it and keep it? Right? I mean, we can talk about our thoughts, but there's actually nothing there that we call thought. There may be an image in the mind or some words that go through, but it's totally empty thought. And it's, in my language, this is my unofficial Buddhist language, this is wild thoughts that we think at all. Could you imagine what it would be like if we didn't think? Remember, everybody wants to not think. They think that's a really good thing. I think it'd be great not to think, you know, but it's not exactly how we were created. We think, but who's doing the thinking, which I believe Pam was pointing at also. I mean, really, I have lots of thoughts that I would give to you gladly, right, that I don't want at all. I'm not even trying to do them, and they come and do themselves. So are they my thoughts, or are they your thoughts, and you're slipping them into my mind stream? Is that what's happening? It's hard to say. I don't think that's what's happening, but I don't know. And so the not knowing is part of reality in my experience. Like, I don't know where thoughts come from. And some thoughts are just great. They're beautiful, or they're delicious, or they're brilliant, or they're wise, or they're skillful. And some thoughts are just like idiotic and make no sense and are all based on totally illogical. And they come at with the same force as the good thoughts at times, you know, and I can't stop them. I mean, I can, you know, they slow down when I'm meditating a lot. They do. They slow down. And I like that. That's really, it's great. And I have had thought stop. And that's pretty wild when it really stops. And it stops two ways. And I'll say a little about both. I don't know if it really stopped the first. I was doing a lot of samadhi practice at some point, and I went very deep in the jhanas, and the jhanas are the absorptions. And part of what happens is a certain point, and the teacher had warned me, he said, if everything stops, don't worry about it. I'm like, okay, if everything stops, what are you talking about? But I kept doing the practice, and you know, and I was just doing mindfulness of breath, but I mean really deeply mindfulness of breath, mind. And then these absorptions would come and everything would get quiet and then still. And then at some point, everything stopped. And I mean, even the breath stopped. And it wasn't just a long pause, which happens when you're doing deep meditation. It's everything stopped. And the experience was I wasn't in this world and I wasn't in the next world. And that was the experience. And that's, but I wasn't thinking it then. It was, there was a reflection of I wasn't in this world and I wasn't in that world when things started again. And so, you know, I'm not sure exactly what happened, but I was glad he warned me that things could stop and I didn't have to worry about it. But it was clear, oh, thoughts could stop. And then, of course, if you have the experience of cessation, which is the first stage of awakening in the Theravadin tradition, then everything stops. And there's not even anybody there to know that everything stops. And that experience is profound and definitely of great value and important. But that is a whole nother level. Consciousness stops, right? Consciousness ceases. And that's not something we can do, but it is something that happens in meditation practice. And it's emphasized in different traditions, some more than less. It's not emphasized in the Zen tradition, but in the Theravadin, it's good, and it is good. And also, some of you know I'm a Diamond Approach teacher, and they also recognize it in the Diamond Approach, which is not a meditation teaching, but is a teaching about the nature of reality. And they also, people experience cessation there. So the head center is opening of what's called metaphorically the eye of wisdom. And not knowing is part of that. Something else I wanted to say about the not knowing. There's not anything else I wanted to say. We'll see if it comes. One of the other extremely important parts of the opening of the head center is awareness. And it kind of points us to the eye of wisdom opening is when we, first of all, do mindfulness, which I understand as a subset of awareness. Mindfulness is a focused awareness, is ability to use our awareness to pay attention to body, heart, mind, sound, smells, taste, touch, thoughts, feelings, reality on every level. And mindfulness is a very brilliant, skillful means. Sati is the word. Sati gets translated actually sometimes as mindfulness and sometimes as awareness. But I think mindfulness a little bit is a subset of awareness, because awareness happens whether we're mindful or not. Awareness is here whether we know it or not. And mindfulness generally has a little participatory energy to it, where we're being mindful. And so I like to point people at awareness. And, you know, we're in the retreat long enough now that we were playing with it in the groups today a little bit about being aware and then being aware of awareness, which mostly we're not. And so I invite all of you to be aware of whatever you're aware of right now. And just notice what you're aware of, whether it's me or the words or your feelings or your thoughts. And you don't have to stop anything. Don't stop anything. Be aware of whatever you're aware of. The sights, sounds, tastes, touch, smells, thoughts, feelings. Right? Can everybody do that? Anybody not do that? Raise your hand if you can't do that. Of course, nobody would raise their hand and say, I can't be aware at all. Because you're already aware. You're aware of something, even aware of liking the talk or not liking the talk, or understanding or not understanding. And so you're already aware. And now I would just encourage you to be aware of what it is that's aware of what you're aware of. If you're aware of my voice, what's aware of it? If you're aware of what you're thinking about what I'm saying, what's aware of it? If you're aware of feeling tired, what's aware of feeling tired? And so I'm pointing you at what you're aware of, and asking you, what is it that's aware of what you're aware of? And of course, this is now a very fundamental Eugene teaching about awareness, which is, I always ask everybody to stop being aware. So would you all please stop being aware just for 1 minute? No, I'm serious. Stop it. Some of you are still being aware. I can tell. You're aware of something. Stop that. And you might notice, and I like to play in this way, because as long as I'm awake in a normal way, I'm aware of something. And I can't stop being aware. Can anybody here stop being aware? You raise your hand if you can. I'd love to say, okay, good. I got at least one no. Thank you. Thank you, Rachel. At least you're confirming what I'm saying. But and it's true. We're not in control. We're not doing the awareness. That's an important understanding. That's an important component of to see that the awareness is doing itself. Because it helps us as we start to keep looking at the head center and the mind and the difference between small mind and big mind. Small mind, we always think we're doing everything. And it's really, really, really helpful, in my opinion, to see we're not doing everything. We're not only are we not doing everything, all the time something is happening that we're not doing, which is awareness. And yet we're always aware of something. So we're aware that we're aware, but we're not aware of the awareness itself. And there are different ways that teachings point at the awareness. Sometimes, and one of my good friends, Kali, she always likes to say this, she's like, oh yeah, just turn your attention back to the awareness. Not what you're aware of, but to the awareness itself. And of course, it was I asked somebody today in a group, I said, can you find the awareness? And they said, no. I said, where is the awareness? And actually what she said was, everywhere. And you should look for yourself to see where is your awareness that allows you to be aware of what I'm saying and what you're thinking and what you're feeling. Where is that awareness? And one of the things I commented after she said it was, I love what Sayadaw Ute Janiya says, because he talks a lot about awareness. He said, there are many, many different ways to experience awareness, not just one way. And so that starts to give you a lot of room to see, how do you experience awareness? Which doesn't mean how do you think about awareness, because to be honest, I don't care how you think about it. How do you experience it? Where is it? How do you understand it experientially? That's the Buddhist question from my perspective. So awareness is part of one of the doorways to opening, to realizing the eye of wisdom. It's part of the eye of wisdom, the head center. And then I think of mindfulness and concentration as subsets of awareness itself. We can utilize awareness to be mindful or to pay attention to something and then to focus very deeply on something. And see what happens as we utilize these subsets of awareness that include mindfulness and concentration and even clarity of mind to see what's needed so that we can practice skillfully when we're sitting, walking, standing, lying down, when we're have a lot of energy or when we're tired, which is one of the times to really be interested and curious about, oh, can we get clear about how to practice when we are tired instead of having to control the tiredness? So there's also part of the head center opening as a kind of dharmic intelligence that awakens, that includes discernment and creativity and an equanimity and also this kind of openness that I started with about the head center. And with the discernment and creativity, and the word here I have written down is equanimity, but I could say the relaxation of mind, more begins to open. There's more understanding comes. And understanding is one of the I always forget which word I should use, metaphor or euphemism, if it means something else, but you can't tell me now, but you can tell me later. And don't chat me, because I don't read chat while I'm talking. So I'll say it's a metaphor. For awakening, the Buddha used the word understanding. And it's a quote that I love from the Itivataka Sutta. He said, this committed life is lived for the sake of seeing into things and understanding them. And when he says committed life, he's at that point, he's talking about the fourfold sangha and the commitment of both the nuns, monks, laymen, laywomen, right? That kind of commitment that one gives to the Dharma when one becomes part of the fourfold sangha, which we are part of. One of my teachers said, Hamid Ali once talked about this. He said, there's a kind of aesthetic appreciation of the beauty of reality that can happen. And he said, the popular expression, I see, which means I understand, right? When we say, oh, I see, It means I understand. It's that we actually see reality, or we see what's true. We say, I see, meaning I understand. He said it's rooted in the fact of this capacity for perception and understanding. Seeing is tantamount to understanding. The capacity for subtle seeing, meaning starting to see deeper and deeper levels of the truth, right, can be developed to the point of being freed from the limitations of time and space. And Hamid's a deep person. He's done deep practice, and he's not making anything up. I've known him for 30 years quite closely, and his practice continues to deepen and get more subtle. And it at times is totally freed from time and space. So there's one more piece I wanted to say about the head center, the eye of wisdom, and that's wisdom itself, wisdom, because I believe that's part of what we're doing here is seeking wisdom or seeking awakening or the wisdom that comes when the eye of wisdom is open. It's a euphemism for awakening, the opening the eye of wisdom in the text. It's called Mahasati. Sati means mindfulness. Mahasati means great mindfulness. It's a great opening, right, of the eye of wisdom. And we begin to see not just from the small sense of self, but from what's called the big sense of self. We begin to see a little bit the big picture of the Dharma, of the truth, of reality, of what's right here, right now, and everywhere. And another way we start to see when the small sense of self relaxes and this eye of wisdom opens, we begin to see the big picture, and it's part of the equanimity that comes with the head center opening. We see with equanimity. And technically what people generally say is, we see the way things are. We see the way things are. And we see things objectively in proportion on every level in our normal, ordinary life and in our meditative life and in the deepest spiritual understanding. It becomes more objective. It's not a fantasy life. There's certain components that are real, and we begin to understand them. Joseph Goldstein, my friend, teacher, colleague, said in the big picture, when he was talking about objectivity, he said in the big picture, the question is always, is this really a problem? Is this really a problem? Because we all have a lot of dukkha, all different levels of dukkha. And some are problems. But at least for me, a lot of my dukkha is actually not really a problem. It's just Eugene. Eugene has a lot of preferences. He likes this. He doesn't like this. He wants this. He doesn't want this. He would love for the fog to stop in San Francisco, you know, this summer. And I can complain about it like crazy. But is it really a problem? It's not a problem, right? The fires are a problem, right? The fog, that's not really a problem. And so being able to see relative truth, Eugene complaining, is okay, it's fine, as long as one objectively knows, it's not really a problem that it's foggy. Or that whatever I want to eat this morning for breakfast wasn't available. Pam ate it all. And there's no more left for me. So it's like, what are you going to do? And you know, it was a problem for like a minute, but not really. It's not really a problem. There was something else to eat, right? So the opening of the eye of wisdom is not just seeing from the small sense of self, but what's called in Zen is big sense of self, or it's the difference in Zen. Really, it's talked about a small mind and big mind. Small mind and big mind. Small mind, I'm describing to you some of my small mind, right? And then there's another, you know, small mind, I love it, is characterized by a word I think I meant. Did I mention the word papancha here? Did I mention no? Papa, okay, it's worth hearing. It's a great word. I figure what you call it, onomatopoeia or something like that, the word that sounds like what it is, papancha. Yeah. Papancha is technically proliferation of mind. It's the mind just going off on its own, saying anything as if it's true, on and on and on. Oh, yeah. Even now, I mean, my if I let my mind, and I do sometimes, of course, because we're not in control of our mind, my mind will say anything about how the talk is so far. If I go in that direction, say, oh, it's good. It's a good talk. You're nailing it. Or it'll say, oh, my God, you can shut up already. It's a bad talk. You don't know what you're saying. But it's just papancha. It's the mind doing itself. It's not true. Maybe it's true, but I won't really know till later. I won't really get a sense. And even then, who knows, right? I mean, who's deciding if it's a good or bad talk anyways? It's just my mind. It's not me, right? I mean, sometimes I give a bad talk. I want to be honest here, and I'm not happy with that. But sometimes I give a good talk, and I am happy with that. And sometimes I give good enough talks, and that's fine. It's good enough. So the small mind, and I'm characterizing it by papancha. And the other way that I noticed it was getting up this morning. Small mind was in play, and I was thinking about this talk. And I'm like, okay, what am I going to talk about? The head center? Shit, I haven't given a head center talk in a long time. What do I want to say? I don't know. And I'm not clear at all. And I'm nervous about it. And I feel a little nervous. And it's, I'm okay being nervous. But the mind's not relaxed. That I'm aware of. And so I go and I have a little breakfast. And then I thought, okay, get out of here. I just need to get out of the house for a minute. And I take a walk. And I go, and we live right next to the park. So I walk in the park. And I'm walking in the park. And I watch what happens as the mind relaxes. I stop thinking about the talk. And the mind relaxes. And really, I didn't do this, it did itself, but the head center opened. Like I felt the mind relax and I was walking in the park and then I was seeing differently. Like all of a sudden the trees and the plants had this vivacity that I like, this very vivid look, like, oh, they were alive. And it's not like I haven't seen them before, but it was like seeing them brand new and they're beautiful. And the trees and the plants and the light and even with the fog, the color and the quiet and the stillness and the life of that moment comes alive and my head opens. And I start to, and I'm feeling very relaxed, body, heart, mind, walking, happy to walk. And I'm walking and then it's like, oh, this is what I want to talk about, is the mind opening. That's what the head center is about. So it started to do itself. There's another. And I started, here was a piece that's also part of the opening of the head center, is, and I said it before, wonder. I started to wonder about, oh, what is the mind? Where does it come from? And what? How is it And what allows us to let go of the tightness of the mind, of the perspectives, what allows the mind to open, right? And I also, of course, one of the questions, part of the curiosity, the wonder, the interest, which now has arisen as the head center is open, is why do we take it to be my mind? Like we identify with our minds. And I get that it's that whatever is happening is has something to do with this relative location, but I'm not in control of my mind. So why do I think it's mine? It may be just a mind, and minds are here. But we grow up and we're conditioned, we're taught, and it's talked about, oh, it's your mind. Oh, look at your mind. You have horrible thoughts. Or, you know, or your mind is so good, you're so smart. But it's just a mind. It's not mine. The identification is one of the things that blocks the opening of the head center. And so, and part of this all happened with the starting with the small sense of self, feeling the tightness of mind, and not knowing how to do the talk. I didn't know what the talk was going to be. And truth is, now this is really the truth, I still don't know what the talk is going to be. I don't know how much longer I have or what's going to come out. I have notes and I like my notes. I use them, but I still never know what am I going to use or what am I going to say? Because I'm more interested in the aliveness of what's here when the centers are open and that letting that do the teaching. Which means I don't have to know exactly what the teaching's going to be. And of course, this is related to where I started with the Dalai Lama about our task is to be more fully human. When I hear that, I think it means being a human being. And the beingness is what's important in being human. That's how we can be more fully human, not by being more fully a human doing, by being a human being. And being has a lot of resonance with spirituality and what happens when we wake up. The beingness of what's here becomes uncovered or unfurled or unobscured or unhindered, right? Just the freedom of body, heart, mind starts to reveal itself of what it means to be a human being. And you all know this in your own way, and you've all tasted it, whether it's in nature or in athletics or in your studies sometimes, everything starts to open. Oh, I see. That I see is part of the beingness knowing something. It's not just checking off the box. It's really the knowing that's the understanding that's a direct understanding, that's a experiential understanding. I get it. I see. I understand. Right? And it happens at different levels of experience and in different areas of life. Okay, it's good. I just looked at the clock, so I'm still on time. So let's see what else. There's so much more to say. I'll say a little bit. What should I say? Okay. A number of people have asked me to say a little about my near-death experience. And I will say a little bit because it's what happened was quite related to the mind. I had what was called They called it a mild traumatic brain injury. And I, God knows what a non-mild is, but my mind got unplugged totally. And I mean this quite seriously. There was a very serious accident. And it was clear we didn't know if I would ever come back. That was clear. And it was a bicycle accident. I fell. I had a helmet. I hit my head, unconscious, helicopter to the hospital, 5 weeks in the hospital, you know, serious. But my mind was gone. I didn't know how to do things. I barely knew, I could barely recognize people, right, who I knew. And they would come into the room and they would ask me, do you know where you are? And often I would answer these strange, kind of deep sounding answers. I would say, I'm here. But I didn't know where here was, right? And I also don't like hospitals. So that was consistent with Eugene. He didn't like being in the hospital. But part of Eugene died in that accident. And I'm saying this because something died, or the other way we could say it is something let go in that accident. And something never came back. Eugene never came back in the same way. And I didn't understand this even for a while. I didn't even think about it. I couldn't even think about these things because I had a slow recovery that included like going through all the stages of development, like from a baby, basically, to becoming an adult, which took a while and was not easy for me and not easy for anybody around me. But I talked to Jack Kornfield about a year after it happened, and he had been in the hospital with me after it happened. And I said, well, what happened, Jack? And he said, oh, you mean karma? You know, why did you have crap? I'm like, no, I don't care about karma. What happened? And he got what I was asking him. He said, oh, you died. And it was like, he was the first person who said that. As soon as he said that, I know, oh, thank you. That's true. Because Eugene died, and whoever Eugene was didn't come back. And I'm here, and I'm Eugene, right? It's not like there's no Eugene, but the Eugene who died is not the Eugene who came back. And so, and I'm saying this part because the mind was gone, and yet the mind came back, but it isn't the same mind. So whose mind is it if that mind didn't come back, right? Is it my mind? I don't know. And for me, experientially, that's true. I mean, it is true that I'm happy as hell. So much of my capacity has come back. And I know a lot what Eugene knew. I know it's a funny thing to say. I remember Eugene. He's a good guy and all that stuff. But it's from a different perspective, which Pam keeps pointing at, about the shift that has to do with realization. Is shifting our understanding so we start to see things or understand things from a different perspective. And it's part of what it means to wake up, is that we continue. We don't do it once and it ends. We continue to see things from a newer perspective because every moment is actually brand new. And that I'm sure of. Like of everything in this talk, trust that one, because that's true. And okay, I'll end with a quote because I have a lot of beautiful quotes here. Oh. Hmm. This is what's hard for Eugene, is picking the quote because they're all so good. I want to give them all to you. So I'm probably going to read two. Sure, let's go from here. I'll read from the Dalai Lama, who said, I'm going to read from Suzuki Roshi because it ties together small mind and big mind. Suzuki Roshi said that everything is included within your mind is the essence of mind. That everything is included in your mind is the essence of mind. To experience this is to have a religious feeling. Even though waves arise, the essence of your mind is pure. Even though waves arise, even though things we don't like, even though small mind arises, the essence of your mind is pure. It is like clear water with a few waves. Actually, water always has waves. Waves are the practice of water. To speak of waves apart from water, and water or water apart from waves is delusion. Water and waves are one. Big mind and small mind are one. So he's pointing beautifully at the one mind that's right here. And then even more succinctly, I'll read from my great teacher, Ryokan, Japanese Zen master. He said, Buddha is your mind. Buddha is your mind, and the way goes nowhere. Don't look for anything but this. Buddha is your mind, and the way goes nowhere. Don't look for anything but this. If you point your cart north when you want to go south, how will you arrive? Obviously, he's got a little Zen kicker in there. That's quite beautiful. So I'm going to stop here. Let's sit for a minute, please. Buddha is your mind, and the way goes nowhere. Don't look for anything but this. Thank you for your kind attention. I believe it's a period of walking. A period of walking meditation, and then there'll be dinner, supper, or whatever meal you're having after that. Okay, we'll see you again later tonight.